It to my two buddies. Now, my two buddies never became alcoholic, never became problem drinkers as far as I know. Their reaction to this alcohol was much different than mine. What happened to them was they drank about two-thirds of their water glass of whiskey and they'd had enough. You ever drink with people that have enough on you? I mean, how lame is that? Oh, no more for me. I've had enough. Well, that's the last time I'm going to be drinking with you. I want to drink with people that are about the business of getting it done. You know what I mean? You've had enough. But anyway, they had enough on me, and they sat back and they watched the show. Because what happened was I finished my glass, I finished their glasses, I finished the bottle, and I went into my first blackout drunk. Any blackout drinkers in here? Yeah, that's a lot of fun, isn't it? You ever like come to in different towns and... You know, I came to one time in a dinghy. They cast me adrift in a bay, you know, because they had warned me, don't pass out, don't you pass out. And I was good for about 2 hours the last 10 years of my drinking before I passed out. But anyway, I went into my first blackout, and I remember coming to in a field, not knowing how I got there. I trashed the house, and I started to feel that horrible first hangover. You know, you remember your first really bad hangover. You're ill and on a horizontal plane for about 2 days. And that's what happened to me. I was so sick. Now, if anything else besides alcohol would have made me that sick, I never would have gone anywhere near it again. Like if it was strawberries, you know, I would have known never, ever to eat strawberries again or something. But the problem is alcohol did something for me. And what alcohol did for me was, all throughout my early life, I felt uncomfortable with myself and my environment. I never felt right. Whether it was anxiety or restlessness or irritability or discontent or being shy, or whatever you wanted to call it. It was a level of feeling uncomfortable with myself and my environment. And I felt like that from a very young age. I had to force myself to do things that other kids were doing just for fun and for free. Like if I was going to join a team, that would be a horrific emotional thing for me. I'll tell you one of the things that flipped me out when I was a young kid was, does anybody here remember square dancing? All right, well, this is something that they did to us as like sixth graders, which is unbelievably traumatic for a pre-alcoholic. What they would do is they would line up all the women on one side of the gymnasium, all the men on the other, or boys on the other, and they'd blow a whistle, and you'd have to run across the gym and ask a girl to dance real quick before they started playing the music. Are you kidding me? You know, I learned later on what I needed to be able to do something like that was a pint of whiskey. A pint of whiskey, and the dancing lessons in that pint of whiskey. But don't ask me to do something like that sober. And things like that were traumatic for me. So when I had that Four Roses whiskey and I started drinking it, what happened was it took away the fear. It took away those levels and waves of just not feeling right with myself. And all of a sudden, I felt perfect. I felt like I was the funniest guy. I felt like you're lucky to be my friend instead of the way I always used to feel, worrying about what you were thinking about me. I always worried about, you know, what you thought of me. And that booze took that away and made me feel like you're lucky to be in my presence. It was a complete shift in attitude and outlook. It was like putting on a whole new pair of glasses and looking at life the way I thought life needed to be looked at. And then I started projectile vomiting and ended up, you know, coming to in a field. So I was incredibly ill from this experience, but also I learned that there is now a tool. There's a tool that I need to learn how to use to be able to fit into this world, because I am not of this world. I am not like the rest of the people I know. I am different. My case is different, and I need a little bit of booze. So I started to become very preoccupied with alcohol. from that period of time. Whether I was an alcoholic from the get-go, whether I became alcoholic later through drinking, you know, that's an argument I don't really need to have. But I will tell you this, I was preoccupied with alcohol from the first time I drank. I started to think, how am I going to get this alcohol again and not get sick? Where, you know, I'm 13 years old, so where am I going to buy, how am I going to get it bought? The drinking age was 21. What was I going to drink? Who was I going to drink with? Where was I going to drink? I became preoccupied with that. And things like schoolwork and other responsibilities went by the wayside. I started to base my life operational methodology on alcohol and how alcohol was going to fit in because I needed it to feel right. I needed to vacation away from my emotional state. I just needed that. So I didn't become a daily drinker, but I became a weekend drinker at least once a week, and I started to pay prices early on. I mean, by the time I was 17, I was already wrecking cars and getting DUIs and passing out and getting into blackouts and getting into fights and waking up with, you know, stitches, you know, or having to go get stitches, you know, all the little prices that we pay for heavy drinking. But I didn't even consider giving it up. I had 3 DUIs. I had lost a family. I'd had 13 jobs in 10 years. I'd become near unemployable. I weighed about 130 pounds. My eyes were mostly yellow in the morning from liver failure. And I didn't even consider giving up alcohol. I mean, that's how much how deep my relationship was with alcohol. Through a series of events, alcohol started to turn on me, or this, you know, this is my perception, and I started to become incredibly violent when I drank. I was the true Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde that they talk about in the Big Book. I could be a pretty okay guy sober, you know, very non-threatening and even somewhat respectful. You give me enough to drink, and I would plot your death. I mean, I just became unbelievably, psychotically violent. And through a couple of these things, one time I called my boss up in a blackout and threatened his life. I'm going to come in tomorrow. I'm going to kill you. And because it was a blackout, I didn't remember it. So I go walking into work the next day, da-da-da-da-da, you know, and he's like, "You, what are you doing here?" And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" He's like, "You threatened my life." And I mean, things like this were like happening to me all the time. People were going like this when they saw me the next day. Just stay away from me. Just stay away from me. You're crazy. And this was like the last 3 or 4 years of my drinking. This was going on, and I came to one day, and I just couldn't take it anymore. This actual event really was very small compared to all the other things. But remember, I told you I was very attached to what you thought of me, you know, which that's an obsession in itself. That's kind of insane. But I was very attached to that. And this one day, I was an electrician, and I was working with this guy who didn't really like me much. And I was trying to put a screw into a ceiling fixture box, a ground screw. And you put the screw on the end of the screwdriver, and you put it in the box. And I was shaking so bad, the screw, I couldn't do it. The screw kept falling off the end of the screwdriver. I literally couldn't put a screw in a box. And this guy who I was working with was looking at me like, and I could tell what he was thinking. Because if you're an alcoholic, if you're a real alcoholic, you can hear people thinking at you. And what this guy was thinking at me was, "You pathetic, you good for nothing, pathetic, tragically, you know, lame." And you know, I could hear this, and it was so shaming that when I got home that night, I called up a treatment center and I said, "I'm coming in." You know, I was half lit up, and they're like, "Well, who the hell are you?" You know, and they were expecting my call. You know how grandiose we could be. You know, and so anyway, I go in and I do the 28-day spin dry rehab thing, and I mean, I was the only person in there to sign myself in. Everybody that was in there for DUIs or family interventions or, you know, they had a bad drug test or something. Nobody was in there because they wanted to be. They were in there to get out of the jackpot. Out of 60 people, I was the only person who voluntarily signed themselves in. And the only reason I even mention this is to show you that I really wanted to separate from booze toward the end. I recognized, finally, that it was out to get me. And I was going to die, or I was going to kill somebody that I really loved. So I need to separate from it. Or die. I mean, those really I thought were my two options. So I signed myself in, and I went to this treatment center. And this particular treatment center followed a certain methodology that I don't really believe much in anymore. You know, I've been involved in professional treatment for a while, and there are methodologies and protocols that I find have decent outcomes. One of them that I find doesn't have decent outcomes is one called group. Anybody in here ever been in group? A couple of hands, yeah. You identify. How fun is that? You sit around in a circle, and everybody just kind of shares about their day and about their feelings. And you know, I would sit in this group wondering what the hell is going on. And I remember somebody'd be sharing, and I'd be thinking, why don't you just shut up? Why don't you you just sit there and talk about yourself, or you tell somebody who cares? You know, I hope you drink. You know, and because I want to share. You know, I'm waiting for me to share. And I remember this one day there was a counselor, and she identified herself as an adult child of an alcoholic. Okay, now I knew nothing of the recovery terminology or any of that. I understand and certainly respect that today, that program, and understanding that you are an adult child of an alcoholic and so need certain spiritual tools in your life. I respect and understand that. But back then, I didn't know what the hell she was talking about. That's how she started. Like, every time she talked, that's how she started how she talked. And I'm thinking, well, I'm a psychotic alcoholic of a librarian. You know, but I don't say that every time I'm about to talk. What is wrong with her? And she's a counselor. And I remember this one time, I'm sharing. Yeah, share. Sharing all this, you know, whatever it was. And she stopped me. She goes, Chris, hold on. Let me ask you a question. Are you happy, mad, sad, or glad? I'm like, What? I mean, don't ask an alcoholic that. Oh, my God. How do I know? I mean, I was spitting dry. If you take every emotion in the world and you put them into a blender and you turn on 10, you know, that would be my emotional state. How am I supposed to know? You know, I'm psychotic and I want to kill you. How's that? You know, And so, like, I don't know whoever developed group, you know, but it's about as effective as a cobweb against a semi if you have real alcoholism. You know, so I did, like, 15 groups a day for 28 days. And, believed somehow erroneously that, you know, my alcoholism is being treated by that. And what happens is I leave. And they suggest, and you got to remember, I really want to separate from alcohol, okay? I want away from this. I'm threatening to kill people, okay? I don't want to kill people. So I want away from alcohol. Now, I leave the treatment center, and they recommend outpatient. They say, you should go to outpatient. And I did. I paid $60 a night to go to, guess what? Group. And hear morons tell me about their day. I really could care less, you know? And the counselor didn't even talk. He'd sit there, like, you know, listening. I'm like, oh my God. But I did it because I didn't have any other plans. I didn't know any better. So I was going to outpatient, and they recommended off the cuff, if you drink a lot, you might want to go to AA. Which I did. I mean, I was taking these suggestions because I was desperate. And I was going to 2 AA meetings, and I was going to 2 outpatients a week. What more do you people want? And I'm telling everybody that I'm done with alcohol. I quit, and I'm in A&A with the A&As. And, you know, if you're new or just coming back, please don't tell people you're in AA until you get through the steps, okay? We don't need a black eye when you go back out, you know. We really don't. Because that's what I did. I was telling everybody I'm done, and I'm going to two AA meetings, and I'm taking them like it's castor oil treatment. I'm sitting there, and I'm just listening. I'm not really participating. I don't know what I expected. I guess I expected to get, you know, sobriety and recovery through osmosis by sitting in the chair. I guess, and I'm going to outpatient. I mean, I'm treating my alcoholism. I'm following the professional advice. And one day, I'm almost 90 days sober, and I'm on the way to an AA meeting, and the thought crosses my mind. This is what I thought. I swear, this is exactly what I thought. I said to myself, you know, it's been almost 3 months since I've been drunk. I hardly even remember what it's like to be drunk. And I remember somebody said, if you don't remember your last drunk, I don't remember my last week that I was drinking, you might not have had it. And you know, I'm not really doing this AA stuff to the best of my ability. I'm not sharing, and I don't have a sponsor yet. I'll bet you if I buy a gallon of vodka and I drink it, I will go back to AA with a renewed enthusiasm. I mean, you know, I will feel so bad that I will go back and I'll really do it right. So, yeah, you have to understand it. The first step, it talks about the obsession of the mind. And this is really hard. I don't think 9 out of 10 alcoholics understand this concept at the depth you need to understand it at to truly surrender. I wanted away from alcohol so badly that the only way alcohol would go in my body was is if my mind convinced me that a gallon of vodka would improve my sobriety. Think about that. Because I truly believed that, and I bought a gallon of vodka and I started drinking it. And the first drink goes down. Everything's great. The second drink goes down. Good idea. Third drink goes down. Oh my God, what have I done? I've opened up the cage door to the beast. And I'm going to be dragged around by the scruff of my neck for who knows how long. I started to realize the enormity of my mistake. I had turned on the physical craving. And I felt it in my body and I understood that I'd made an unbelievable mistake. Now, think about this. Was I insane? You know, they talk about the insanity of alcoholism. Where was I insane? Before or after I started drinking? The alcohol actually made me, restored me to sanity in a way. The insanity was drinking a gallon of vodka to improve my sobriety. That is insane. I understand the obsession of the mind today as the true nature of powerlessness. If I am truly powerless, like it asks me to admit in the first step, I am not in charge of when alcohol goes back in my body in an unrecovered state without being in fit spiritual condition. I'm not in charge. I can't just not drink no matter what. I can't just think the drink through. I have no adequate defense against the first drink. And that relapse, that buying the vodka and drinking it, made me realize how much trouble I was really in. If you're new, just coming back, have not been through the steps, there are two truths that I will tell you right now are true that you don't believe. One of them is you're in way more trouble than you think you are. However much trouble you think you're in, multiply it by 10 and you'll be getting close. Because that's how aggressive alcoholism is. The second truth is there's more of an answer for all of the issues in your life in Alcoholics Anonymous than you're giving Alcoholics Anonymous credit for. I drank for another 5 months, 7 months, something like that. I don't remember. It culminated in a horrible situation at Christmas at my mother's house where I threatened my entire family with a .38 caliber handgun in a drunken blackout. Because somebody might have said something. I don't even remember why I was mad. And I come out of that blackout, and I was absolutely shattered. It talks about in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, the jumping off point, where you'll wish for the end. You will not be able to even conceive of a life with alcohol anymore, or you could not possibly conceive of a life without alcohol. You're in that bleak twilight zone of pathetic existence called the jumping off point. And that's where I was. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And then I started to go into the DTs, which is terror, frustration, bewilderment, and despair. And I mean, nothing is suffering like that. I mean, you talk to anybody who truly understands suffering. My wife is a hospice nurse, okay? She'll tell you that there's nothing like the suffering of an alcoholic. Nothing. Someone quoted Mother Teresa. Asked Mother Teresa, "What's the saddest thing you've ever seen?" And it wasn't the people starving to death in Calcutta. It was, she said, it was the loneliness of the alcoholic. And I believe that. I believe that we suffer unbelievably. And in this 4 or 5 day detox, where I was hallucinating, there was animals running. I mean, you know, marching bands, demons coming out of the ceiling. I was freaked out because it was unbelievably intense DTs, and a lot of us die from those. But I made it through, and I decided that I'm going to go back to AA. I don't have another plan. I don't know if it's going to work. I don't know if it's going to work, but I can't keep drinking, and I just don't have the courage to kill myself. You know, so I think what I'll do is I'll go back to AA, and I'll throw myself in front of a sponsor and ask him to tell me what to do. And that's what I did. I found this guy who had been bringing in meetings when I was in treatment. And I went up to him and I said, "Phil, I've been in hell. I want to get out. Would you be my sponsor?" And like all good sponsors who are confronted with a sponsee who's in incredible pain, he laughed at me. "Well, I could use another pigeon," he says. Now, again, you got to understand, I'm not in AA long enough to understand a lot of the terminology. I'm thinking pigeon. The thing I can remember is the James Cagney movies, where if someone was a stool pigeon, you know, it was somebody that, you know, would rat somebody out, and you'd have to kill them. So I'm thinking, pigeon. Okay, you know, I mean, I was that desperate. I'll be your pigeon. Who do you need me to spy on? And I became this guy's pigeon. Now, my first sponsor was not what you would call a big book recovery guy. My first sponsor was what much of Alcoholics Anonymous was in the tri-state area at this point in time. He was a fellowship guy. He was a fellowship in service. And thank God he was at least two parts of the triangle, because I could have got a sponsor who was just fellowship. But he at least had service commitments, and he hooked me in. He made me get involved with service commitments. And I was doing treatment center talks and, you know, volunteering for this and over there at that. I mean, he literally made me do all these service commitments. And thank God for that, because being a real alcoholic, being somebody who is in real trouble with alcoholism, sitting in a few meetings would not have worked. It didn't work the first time I tried it. You know, sitting in group and sharing did not work. I needed something more significant. And thank God he introduced me to service. But I was still one-fold shy. You know, this is a threefold illness with a threefold solution, meeting steps and service. And I'm going to meetings and I'm doing service, but I don't have any steps in my life. Now, one of the things I'm really enjoying about this weekend is Larry and Charlie are bringing back wonderful memories for me. I'm about 6 months sober, and somebody comes up to me and hands me 8 90-minute tapes, and they say, "You're hardcore, dude. You'll like these. I don't care for them much, but you might like them." And they hand me a Joe and Charlie workshop from the mid-80s, and I start to listen to it. Now, one thing that will happen to you if you're an alcoholic is the truth is going to haunt you. It may be inconvenient, and it may piss you off, but you're going to have to deal with it if it's the truth. You're going to have to process it. And I started to listen to these tapes, and the first thing I thought was, these guys are from Arkansas. What does anybody from Arkansas know about me? And I started to think, you know, they talk like really slow. We get more talking done by 9 o'clock than these guys. you know? And then they start to talk so that I'm getting the impression that they're criticizing my AA. Because we don't do it like that. We don't sponsor like that. We read the step book. We got step meetings, and we do 12 and 12 meetings. Nobody has a big book meeting in New Jersey. What are these guys talking about? And the first time you're confronted with a truth that you're going to need to process, you get pissed off. And I got pissed off, and I threw these tapes up on the shelf. Okay, like Arkansas. And what happened was, I went about the business of fellowship and service for another 6 months. And I started to get tore up. How that presented is like this. I would walk into an AA meeting and I would be overcome with the feelings of uncomfortability. I would sit down and I'd think, you know, halfway through the meeting I'd have to go to the bathroom, and I'd go, I gotta go to the bathroom, but if I get up, everybody will be looking at me and they'll be saying, oh, that guy needs to go to the bathroom, and, you know, what a loser, you know, and after the meeting somebody would come up to me and they'd go, Chris, how you doing? And I'd give the regular AA salute, great, doing great. Meanwhile, I'm thinking, you shared about gratitude tonight, and what I wanted to do was go outside in the parking lot, cut your tires, and see how grateful of an alcoholic you are with four flats after the meeting. That's what I want to do to you. You shared too long. And meanwhile, I'd have a big smile, like, great, great, doing great. I'm psychotic and I want to kill you, but I'm doing great. And I would go home after a meeting. I would go home and I need to put a drink together. I need to put a drink together, and I'd go into the ice box, and the ice cube tray would be empty. And I'd freak out. There's no ice. Don't you know I need ice? What's the matter with you? And this is after sharing about gratitude. So what's happening is spiritually, I'm not healing. Yes, I'm healing a little bit physically because I'm not drinking. I'm healing a little bit mentally because I'm not going through this traumatic, thank you. I'm not going through this traumatic, you know, episodes of blackouts and everything. So I'm calming down a little bit, but spiritually I'm still really screwed up. I'm just not comfortable. Nothing feels right. There's no satisfaction, no serenity in my life. And I start thinking back about these tapes. Because in these tapes, it talked about a significant solution. A solution for the alcoholic that would bring about a new freedom and a new happiness. It would bring about a change in perception. I believe a miracle is a shift in perception. We will no longer see the world or see our interaction in the world the same, nor will we respond the same way. That's really a spiritual awakening. That's really the difference between being recovered and unrecovered, is that shift in perception that happens through practicing spiritual principles and exercises. So I pull these tapes off the shelf and I go, okay, all right, maybe these guys from Arkansas got something. They sure talked with authority. So I start playing these tapes and I open up a notebook and I start following, and I open up a big book and I start going through these tapes, and where it says to do something, I pause the tape and I did it before I went on. In other words, and not out of any sense of virtue, please don't think, you know, I was trying to become a better AA member. I just didn't want to feel bad anymore, is really what my motivation was. And I knew there was something drastically wrong with me, and my days were numbered in Alcoholics Anonymous because I was not getting better. I knew that. So I went through these tapes, and this is the first time I did a four-column inventory. It's the first time I did a fear inventory. It's the first time I did a harms to others, emphasis on sex inventory. It was the first time I put together a real amends list and methodically went out and did it. What these tapes did for me was they put the word actually in front of every step. I actually did a moral inventory. I actually went out and made amends. I actually started a prayer and meditation regime. I actually started to carry the message to other alcoholics. And this is a this was a process that happened over, you know, I don't even know how many months, maybe even years. But by about 1992 or 93, I had a different program. And this was something that was unique to me in this area. It was going against the grain. You will find if you go around enough, and I know that Larry and Charlie understand this because they go around quite a bit. You'll find that quite possibly the area where Alcoholics Anonymous is least concerned with true recovery is the tri-state area around New York City. It emanates out from New York City. It's psychological fellowship, and there's very little emphasis on steps. So I'm doing the stuff that's being practiced in other parts of the country that a lot of people have been involved with for many years, the Denver Young People's Group. There's places in Texas and Florida that were way into this stuff, North Carolina. But in my area, there really wasn't anybody working from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not even telling anybody I'm doing it, you know, because I don't want them to think I'm a wackadoo. But what's happening is I'm starting to recover from alcoholism. Now, I'm sponsoring people at this point in time because I learned right away, because I went to so many groups, I learned how to give good share. You know how you give good share? You make sure that you don't say anything controversial that anybody will, you know, critique you on. And you're very self-deprecating. And you talk about your own little problems and how stupid you were today. Ha, ha, ha. And that's how you give good share. And I knew how to do that. And I was doing that. And sometimes the tugboat with the most steam gets the tow jobs. So what happened was I got a whole bunch of sponsees, a whole bunch of these people. Like, would you sponsor me? And, my immediate reaction was, yes, what's your name and what's your problem? You know, yes. And I don't do that anymore, but I was doing it back then. And I was getting all these knuckleheads who were making me look bad because they were drinking on me. You ever have sponsees drink on you? Make you look bad? Somebody comes up to you, you know Harry's drinking? And he's hitting on the women and he's borrowing money? Is Harry yours? Yeah, Harry's mine. I'll talk to him. You know, and I got kind of tired of this, so I came up with this idea. It was something that was suggested in these tapes anyway, and I started to bring people over to my house. This is like 1993, 92. I started to bring these people over to my house and started to take them through the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And what we would do is we would open up on the title page and we would start to go through. And where there was an instruction, we would stop and we would do the best we could with that instruction until we moved on. And I believed at that time, you know, I don't necessarily believe it exactly today, but I believed at that time that I couldn't ask anybody to do something that I wasn't willing to do myself. So every single time I was taking people through the book, I was doing my own inventory and I was doing my own spiritual exercises. And I'm not going to tell you that that's how I take somebody through the book today, but that's how I was doing it early on. So I didn't really know any better. So I'm going through the steps multiple times, and I'm starting to recover from alcoholism. All of a sudden, that interior uncomfortability that I was suffering from, you know, that anxiety, I don't know what's wrong, but I don't want to be here doing this. I'd be better off over there doing that. You know that feeling. And that started to leave me. And some of the promises started to come true. And now I'm starting to recover and I'm starting to gain spiritual strength. Now, I'd always been a really bad employee. I mean, I came to an Alcoholics Anonymous and I was an electrician. I was a bad one, too. I mean, I blew stuff up. I was forever drilling it into the wrong place and pulling suits through the holes in the walls. And, you know, I can't tell you how many bad mistakes I made, you know, wiring things up that wouldn't work. And this one time I wired a whole kitchen addition to a timer meter. I didn't realize it was a panel off of a hot water heater timer meter. And what that means is it goes on at 8 o'clock at night and off at 6 in the morning to catch the cheap rates. So this whole kitchen would come on at 8 o'clock at night and go off at 6 in the morning. And, you know, you keep doing stuff like that, and, you know, you call attention to yourself, as it were. Now, when I started to work these principles, when I started to work this program in my life, certain things started to happen, and it wasn't like I was directly going after them. What I was directly going after was Alcoholics Anonymous, because I knew I would die without it. So the number one priority was meetings, steps, service, working with the guys, going to the meetings, following to the best of my ability the suggested philosophy and spiritual exercises and one's sober demeanor, trying my best to align with that in my life. That was the most important thing. And I started to become promotable. And I went from being a very bad electrician to being in charge of an electric crew, and then being in charge. And you know, I've stumbled my way through career choices to the point where today I'm in charge of a pharmaceutical plant, the facility department for a pharmaceutical plant. You know, don't ask me, with like 100 employees and you know millions of dollars worth of budget and tons of responsibility. And I do a pretty good job at it. As far as my personal relationships, you know, go, they've improved also. But it all started from the recognition of the first step. I truly had to get a good picture of the first step. It's the most misunderstood step in Alcoholics Anonymous today. Many people come in here and believe that the meetings are the treatment for alcoholism. All they really need to do is go to the meetings to re-encourage them to want to stay sober. You know, the more meetings I go to, the more I'll remember that I want to stay sober. As long as I remember I want to stay sober, as long as I don't want to drink, everything is fine. And so many people believe that. They don't understand what the book Alcoholics Anonymous says up through the first three chapters. First three chapters paint a very bleak picture, people. And if you are what the book calls a real alcoholic or an alcoholic of the hopeless variety, you're going to need to give yourself completely to this program, or your life is going to just be destroyed an inch at a time from alcoholism. And it's very, very sad to see. What convinced me was really, really wanting to not drink and ending up drinking. I guarantee that at any AA meeting or any outpatient meeting, 2 weeks before I drank, I was the person in that room that wanted to stay separated from alcohol more than anybody else. I guarantee it. I guarantee it. I just know that. And yet I drank. So wanting to not drink was meaningless to me. Now the true realization of that is scary. That you will not want to relapse, and you will. That's what pushed me into AA with a willingness born of desperation. And I totally understand that today. Now, in step two, I had issues with organized religion. I really did. And the term God would come up. And what I would relate it to was something very distorted. Because what happens is we come into Alcoholics Anonymous with distorted thinking. And the issue with that is we really think we're right. We know so many things. 100% we know these so many things that are wrong. And when I read the second step, or I was in a second step meeting, or somebody would mention God, what would dawn on me is right around the time I got sober was around the time that Jim and Tammy Faye Baker were selling like 200,000 condos, and they only had 1,000 condos. They were robbing all these people from the heavenly condos. And Jim Swaggart, another televangelist, was like calling me a sinner every Sunday morning on his TV show and calling me to repent. And he's getting caught in Texas motels with hookers, you know. And I'm thinking, what hypocrisy. These are like God's front three, you know, and I don't want anything to do with that. I may be an alcoholic, you know, I may be a heathen, but I'm not a hypocrite. You know, I'm not robbing, you know, widow money. You know what I mean? I'm just not doing that. You know, so I had a lot of deep-seated prejudice against those of a religious nature. And I had to learn the difference between spirituality and religion. And that was a hard lesson for me to learn. But for me to move forward, I had to learn that. And really, my understanding of spirituality, I really started to understand it when I started to study some of the history. A lot of the history that's being talked about this weekend, the Oxford Group. You know, a lot of alcoholics were getting sober in these groups, like the Oxford Group, the Jacobi Club, the Emmanuel Movement. A lot of alcoholics were getting sober. I'm not saying they were recovering, but they were able to achieve and maintain some sobriety in these evangelical movements. And I believe it had to do with practicing spiritual principles. I believe it had to do with joining a fellowship with a common type of solution. And although I don't see that there was a lot of recoveries in these groups, there was a lot of sobriety. So I started to see that what I need to do is I need to set aside my prejudice. I need to set aside my preconceived notions about spirituality, about God, about everything, and become willing to practice spiritual principles. I don't need to understand everything. I don't need to understand the theology of it all. What I need to do is I need to become convinced that my feet have to do certain spiritual things. I need to become of service. I need to start developing a service ethic. And there's some other spiritual principles and other spiritual exercises inherent in the steps, inherent in the traditions and the concepts that I need to become willing to start to practice in my life. And it's through the practice of those principles and exercises is going to afford me the necessary spirituality to move forward in this program. I don't need to be perfect at this stuff. I just need to resign from the debating society. I have to stop being the person on the Titanic who's not willing to get off until he finds out who was in charge of looking for icebergs. You know, who cares who was in charge of looking for icebergs? You're going down! Get in the lifeboat! So I need to think more about getting in the lifeboat than in about Jim and Tammy Faye Baker and how these religious people are robbing people. Need to get in the boat. I'm going down. So in step three, I believe my early experiences with step three and how that's developed for me is, am I in? Am I in this thing or am I out? I understand what I need to do. I understand that there's a commitment that I need to make. I understand that I have to embrace this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous with its you know, many different principles and systems. I need to make it a part of my life. Am I in? Or am I going to try to do this on my own? Am I going to try to figure this out? You got to understand, I realized in my final relapse that I was never going to be able to figure this out. There had to be some other answer for me, because alone, my unaided will is going to take me back to alcohol. It's going to. So there has to be something more significant. So in step three, basically, I said, okay, I'm in. I'm in. You know, I'm in. And this was more of a process than it was a decision. I believe that the third step prayer is an affirmation prayer. I think that we say that prayer after we've already decided we're in. So I decided, yes, I'm in. I will do my best with these steps. I will stay consistent with meetings. I will carry this message to other alcoholics, even if they're knuckleheads and I don't like them. I'll do it. You know, I will make a commitment to this thing. And that basically was my step three. Now, remember the question that I asked, that people were asking me? What's wrong with you? What is wrong with you? Do you know what you did last night? Do you know you were grabbing the boss's wife's ass at the Christmas party? Oh, no! What's wrong with you? In step four, I start to see truly what's wrong. If you are an alcoholic and you have not done a fourth step, you don't know what's wrong with you. The first true picture of what is wrong with me started to dawn when I started to do a resentment, a fear, and a conduct inventory. That's when I started to see the motivations in my life. How my instincts that are out of control and abnormal because of my alcoholism, how they're causing me to react in ways that are not conducive to, you know, to spiritual principles, and how alcohol ends up being an anesthetic for this type of horrible behavior, and how I get caught up in that cycle, and I start to see how truly my problems are of my own making. That is a shift in perception that is incredible to witness. One of my favorite things is when I'm taking somebody through the steps and the lights come on. They start to say, oh my God, and they start to get it. And they start to see that their problems are not coming at them, their problems are coming from them. That at best they co-create all the disorder in their life. At worst, they create it completely. They step on the toes of their fellows and their fellows retaliate. You know, somewhere, somehow we've set the ball rolling and, you know, we've been harmed because of what we're doing and what our perspective is on life. And I start to see what my real problem is. You know, right, my real problem is my approach to the world, my relationship to the world, and how distorted it's become because of my alcoholism. That's my real problem. How does alcoholism present? It presents in so many different ways. When we're new, we come in here and we don't understand how aggressive alcoholism is. Your personal relationships are going to be in the toilet. They just are. You know, you're going to have problems with so many people. That's how alcoholism presents. Emotionally, you're going to be filled with guilt, shame, remorse, anxiety, depression. That's how alcoholism presents. That's alcoholism. That's not life on life's terms. That's untreated alcoholism. And it's so aggressive, and it's so cunning, and it's so baffling, and it's so powerful. I start to realize the enormity of this problem in step four. And I start to look at my part in it. Now, step five, I've got to share this stuff. I need to become honest with this stuff. I need to admit that, yes, these are some of the issues. These are some of the issues in my life. This is how I'm wrong, how I've been wrong. So I do that. I've done maybe 8 or 9 fifth steps with different people. I just got done doing a fifth step about 2 months ago. With one of my sponsees, and it was a great experience for me. I got current with the dysfunction in my life, you know, which isn't anywhere near what it used to be like. But it's still significant enough to corrode my spiritual condition if I don't address it. So I need to continue to address it, even though it's mild compared to the psychosis I came in here with in year one. So in step five, I admit to this stuff. Here's how I'm wrong. Oh boy, can't wait to do this, but I go through the whole list. This is everything that I see. And I usually do a fifth step with someone who I've given spiritual consent to, who will be honest with me, and if I need to be hammered, I'll be hammered. If something needs to be pointed out to me, it will be pointed out. I make it very, very clear to whoever I'm doing a fifth step with that it's a life and death errand. And you need to worry less about what I'm going to feel about what you say than what you see is the truth. Step six. My character defects. I've recognized many of them in step four. These are issues. These are behaviors. These are attitudes that I have that are causing my failure in life. They are directly proportional to my alcoholism, these defects of character. I need to understand the enormity of the problem. These character defects are not something I can wish away or read a self-help book and get over. Anybody in here have self-help books when you got sober, like a library of self-help books? Oh, yeah. Well, absolutely. You know, listen, the self-help industry is kept alive by alcoholics. It truly is, you know. I mean, I can't tell you how many of them I had. They didn't ever do anything for me because I was never willing to commit to whatever process they had. As soon as they asked me to do something, you know, inconvenient, I would put the book aside. I was hoping to get it through osmosis. And there's nothing more selfish than having a library of self-help books. My sponsor came over one time. He goes, "Hey, these are all your self-help books, Chris?" I'm like, yeah, Phil. He goes, "Well, where's your help other books? You got a lot of self-help books. Where's all your help other books?" I'm like, "What do you mean, Phil?" You know, typical. You know, the book Alcoholics Anonymous is this help other book? That's really what it's about? Anyway, in step six, I have to recognize that these defects of character are too much for me. If I could just decide to be good, I probably would have done it a long time ago. I need to become willing to have God remove these defects of character. And then in an attitude of humility, I need to ask God to remove these defects of character. In an attitude of humility. My understanding of humility today is an accurate self-appraisal. I always was appraising myself either too grand or too bad. I was always the worst or I was always the best. I could never be middle of the road. It was just not, I knew I was a scumbag, but I was a special scumbag. I was not a run-of-the-mill scumbag, you know? And that's just typical of the alcoholic. So I believe that humility is you need to get an accurate self-appraisal, something that alcoholism doesn't allow you the dignity to understand until you start into a recovery process. But I need to go to God in an attitude of humility, saying, "Look, you know, my alcoholism was too much for me. My drinking was too much for me. These defects of character are too much for me. I am telling you right now, I'm willing to do the rest of these steps. I'm willing to go out and make amends where these defects of character have harmed others, other people in other institutions. I'm willing to do that. You know, please take away these defects of character." And what I do is, the best possible atmosphere to be in for the removal of character defects is to become willing to go out and make direct amends. And actually, I'm going to put that word in front of this, actually go out and make direct amends to the institutions and people that I've harmed. And I became willing to do that, and I've done that. I've done that in my past. I'm still working on a couple of things that I need to finish up. But I will tell you this, that in general, I'm okay with the world today. Now, defect of character removal. Some of them got removed right away. Road rage. Road rage disappeared one day. I used to be the kind of guy who would be right on your bumper. If you weren't doing 45 and a 45... If you were doing 40 in a 45, I would let you know that you're slowing me down. Okay? And it's not right for you to be slowing me down. There's a speed limit. All of a sudden, road rage was gone. My violent characteristics were gone. And over the course of time, my need to argue and be right was gone. My need to fight about certain things was lifted. A number of these character defects. I'm not saying I'm perfect. I'm not saying that I'm not still based in selfishness in certain areas and places. But for the most part, many of these defects of character, especially the defects of character that were getting in the way of my usefulness to God and my fellow man, have been removed. And it wasn't because I specifically went after it. It was because I decided I would participate in the rest of the program, steps 8 and 9 specifically. Step 10 I see today very clearly as a reactive step. It's my walking around step. It's when I'm engaging in life, there are certain principles that I need to use as an alcoholic to be able to participate in the maintenance of my spiritual condition. I believe that it says in the 12 and 12, God is not going to render you as white as snow without your cooperation. So how then shall I cooperate? If it's going to require cooperation, let's be clear about how I cooperate. I need to cooperate by practicing these principles in all my affairs. And step 10 really is a walking around step for me. How I'm reactive, how I live needs to be based somehow on the spiritual principles inherent in the steps. Because I'm an alcoholic, I don't have another choice. You know, there are people out there who have the ability to be horses' asses. And they do it with impunity. And, you know, impunity means not to be punished. If I do it long enough, punishment will be swift. And it will be brutal. It will be alcoholic punishment. I cannot remain out there operating from a selfish platform. I need to be operating from a platform based on love and service and compassion. I just do. It's in my own best interest, let me tell you. Step 11, there are things that I do with step 11 today that are the absolute pinnacle of joy in my life. I understand that in the morning, I need to do morning meditation and morning prayer. I have a way of doing that that lines up very, very well with the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I understand I need to do an evening review at the end of the day that includes just basically an accurate appraisal of what went on throughout the day and what I need to ask God for help with, and maybe I need to make some amends, whatever. And I also understand that through the day, I need to be cognizant of, you know, basically step 10. I need to be reminded on an almost moment-by-moment basis that God is the most prominent thing in my life. There was a great piece of writing in the New Testament. Paul writes in one area, he tasks someone with praying without ceasing. And what I take that to be is having the awareness of the consciousness of the presence of God in my life. On a moment-by-moment basis, being aware of the consciousness of the presence of God in my life. And that's the most important thing in my life today. And where it suggests that there are great books out there, you can get suggestions from priests, ministers, or rabbis. Oh man, have I done so. I have a wonderful collection of spiritual books these days. Not necessarily self-help books, spiritual books. I've been studying comparative religion for about 15 years now. And I'm deep into some really heavy, really fun stuff. And where I find that it's truly useful for me and to me is where I apply it. Because to seek knowledge for the sake of knowledge is kind of empty for the alcoholic. To seek experience, that's everything. Where we can actually put it into practice in our lives, that's where it becomes beneficial to an alcoholic. Because we live or die by our experience, not our knowledge. So step 11 is wonderful for me today. Step 12, I have had revelations over the years with step 12. I believe that my life system needs to be based on step 12. I spend more hours of my week today than I ever have before in 12-step pursuits. My 12-step work looks a little different than it did, you know, back in the early 90s, but I'm about the business of 12-step work. I'm about the business of carrying the message to other alcoholics, carrying the message to people who need a spiritual message. And, you know, I find that that's incredibly valid. Now, one of the things I started to do when I sponsored, because I was wasting a lot of time with guys. There was a lot of people that were coming up and asking me to sponsor them because they wanted me as a co-signer to their crap. If they had Chris S. as a sponsor, you know, nobody would mess with them. And what they would do is they would ask me to sponsor them, and then they really weren't going to be legitimate. They really weren't going to be 100% committed to the recovery process, that the kit of spiritual tools that I was laying out at their feet. And they were using me to dodge and weave. And because I was saying yes to everybody, I learned some lessons. I got very, very detailed in a study of the chapter Working with Others. And I base my sponsorship today, on the chapter working with others, which is not something I did for many, many years. In the chapter working with others, it says some strong things. It basically says if someone is not willing to go through the steps with you, cut them loose. Oh, you're not willing to do a four-step? You're not willing to go out and make amends? Bye-bye! That's basically what it says. That's some tough stuff. It took me a long time to be able to say, okay, I'll do that, because I didn't want to hurt anybody's feelings. But I was wasting my time. There were people I was spending hours and hours with. All they wanted me really to do was be their drama coach. Oh, here's what's going on in my life, and here's the jackpot, and I'll call you tomorrow, click. You know, and I was basically a drama coach, and it was a waste of my time. Now, if I follow the outline in the chapter, working with others, you know, I'm going to make very, very clear from the outset what my expectations are. And if you're okay with those expectations and you meet those expectations, we're going to be good. If you're not, then, you know, please, here's my phone number. You can call me, you know, if you become ready. But I only know one way to recover from alcoholism, and it's to go through the steps. I don't, you know, I tried going to a lot of meetings and sharing, and it didn't work for me. I wanted to kill myself. And I wasn't honest anyway when I was sharing. So if you want to work with me, I'm going to qualify you. It says in the book, we need to be sure we're working with an alcoholic. Does that mean that if we come to the conclusion that somebody's a heavy drinker or a drug addict, that we need to, you know, just nix them off? No. We don't have to work with them if they're not an alcoholic. We can be helpful, absolutely, and I'm helpful to anyone. But I am not going to make a commitment to somebody, because if you're not alcoholic, there's a really good chance you're not going to summon up the fortitude to go through a 12-step program. Because there's pieces of that 12-step program that are going to be really inconvenient to you. You know, you're going to have to go back to Mrs. McGillicuddy, your second grade teacher, and apologize for putting the razor blade in that apple. And that's going to be real inconvenient. But, you know, that's one example. Now, in that book, it basically says on the first visit, you know, what are you going to do on the first visit? On the first visit, it tells you. It tells you what to do on the second visit. It tells you what kind of a commitment to get from the person. It tells you what you need to do, what you need to share, what kind of experience you need to bring to bear, and what kind of time you're going to be spending with the individual. And in today's day and age, there are some wacky concepts of sponsorship out there. There are groups that have hierarchical kind of sponsorship stuff where there's one guy way at the top who dictates down, you know, from on high, directions for everybody and how they're supposed to behave and how they're supposed to act. You know, I don't see that in the chapter working with others. What I see in the chapter working with others is we share the simple kit of spiritual tools with someone, and we help them to go through the steps, and then they become, first of all, you are a prospect if you're trying to convince somebody that they're alcoholic, their life is unmanageable, and they need a spiritual program. You're offering your experience to them. They're a prospect. Then they're a protege when they start to work with you. And once you've gone through the steps with them, then you're on a peer level. It talks about being friends. You know, and that's really what it talks about in the chapter working with others. I don't know where you get this stuff where, you know, it's the sponsor makes you wax his car every weekend or some crazy thing like that. You know, I try to base my working with others from that chapter. And here's what I've learned. Do I lose a lot of people right out of the gate? Boom, right out of the gate, I lose a lot of people. But you know, those are usually the people I would have wasted my time for months with, and they would have left, and you know how people weasel out of AA? They slide out like slippery weasels, and all of a sudden you just don't see them anymore, and you've worked with them for 6 months, you know, you've met their family and gone to traffic court with them and all this, and all of a sudden they weasel and slippery slide their way right out of AA. You know those people? I don't get involved with them if I set the stage from the very beginning. I'm not wasting my time. you know, if I say, look, we're about the business of going through the steps. You know, I'll do anything I can to help you, but we're about the business of recovering from alcoholism, because that's the most important thing here. You know, and I've learned that the people that have said yes to that are all still sober today. Every single person that has gone through the steps with me in that way and is consistent with meeting steps in service to this day, and usually if you go through the steps, inherent in that is the experience of being consistent with meetings and steps in service, because of the recovery experience leads you into that. They're all still sober, every one of them. There's a book called the DSM-4. It's basically the textbook that medical doctors use when they're diagnosing people with different diseases. And alcoholism in the DSM-4 is described as a chronically relapsing condition. So when you go into a doctor, you've heard people say, tell the doctor you're an alcoholic. You know, always tell the doctor you're an alcoholic. I don't necessarily buy into that today, and I don't do it. But let's say you still do. You're telling the doctor that you're a chronic relapser, because that's what alcoholism is defined as in these books. Now, I don't know about anybody in here, but I don't want to chronically relapse. I want to stay in a recovered state. Am I going to have some ups and downs? Am I going to have, you know, challenges in my life that are going to emotionally drain me in different ways? Absolutely. You know, in the last 3 years, I moved 4 times, changed 3 jobs, lost my mother, who was about the closest family member ever in my life, got a divorce, remarried. You know, my daughter just got married. I mean, I can't tell you about how many large-scale, huge changes there were in my life. Changes that would beat the hell out of me back in the day, because change was very, very rough. Through all of it, I've been able to remain serene, a level of serenity, a level of not taking it personally, like these events are happening to me. They're happening, and I'm a spiritual being having a human experience, is how I perceive this stuff today. And I'm incredibly, incredibly grateful for being on this planet. I really am. This is a marvelous experience that we're all having. And the more I grow spiritual, the more gratitude I have for the opportunity to be on this planet. I think it's an unbelievable gift that so many people take for granted. And people not only take it for granted, but they get so sick that, you know, they'll even commit suicide. They'll want out of this wonderful experience. Do you know that the alcoholic is about 60 times more likely to take their own life than a non-alcoholic? Try to get life insurance, and when there's a box to check, you know, have you had alcoholism treatment in the last 5 years? Check that box and see what happens. You know, you'll realize something very, very quick. The insurance actuaries understand just how much trouble we're in, you know, because of suicide and early death that comes on from alcoholism. So it's something that needs to be taken seriously. In the country today, I believe that there's some things that we need to do that go above and beyond the 12-step work that it talks about in this book. And I've been participating in it. No disease or illness that exists has a worse reputation or more stigma or discrimination than alcoholism, and especially drug addiction. Today, more people are affected by alcoholism, substance abuse addiction. More people are affected by substance abuse addiction than heart disease and cancer put together. The figures are astronomical. They're in the tens of millions of people are affected each year through substance abuse and addictive illness. And yet the treatment for it is ineffective. The reimbursement for it is not enough. There's not enough research that's going into it. There's not enough attention that's paid to it. There's not enough legislation that's being passed to make it more survivable if you have it. right now, you know, right now, and one of the things that contributes to this whole thing, I believe, is the 11th and 12th traditions. Not necessarily the spirit of the traditions, but how people, how individuals interpret these traditions. They believe that to be an anonymous program means to be secret about your illness or your alcoholism. Now, in the early days of AA, Marty Mann and Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob got involved in the National Council on Alcoholism, something that I'm part of today. And the whole purpose for that group was to end stigma and discrimination by saying treatment is available and recovery is possible. Without that, this discrimination and the injustice that happens to us is going to continue. One of the things that I'm married to a nurse, okay? One of the great things that she told me she would do, she was an ER nurse, and come Friday and Saturday night, the drugs would show up, okay? And it was always a pain in the ass. Everybody hated it when the drugs came in. And this one drunk comes in one time, and he's detoxing, he's hallucinating, he's DTing. And it's like Sunday morning, and this person's just freaking out in DTs, you know, strapped to the bed. And down the hall is the children's cancer wing, and they have a clown. So her and her friends decide to send the clown in to talk to the alcoholic. So the clown comes in, and the guy's like, "Ah!" You freak out. So they would play like jokes on the alcoholics. But, you know, one of the things we need to do, people, we really do, it's a call to action, is when we can. I'm not saying to go around saying you're in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm in AA. What I'm saying is where it's appropriate and where it's available to you to let people know that recovery is possible. Because what my wife thought was, here's what she saw. One screwed up alcoholic after another coming into the hospital. And they'll come in, "Oh, you gotta help me, you gotta help me." And, you know, they get a little bit of Librium, you know, a little bit of Suboxone, whatever the drug of, you know, detoxing is today. And they'd start to feel a little better. And then they'd start to realize that they're doing it wrong in this hospital. What are you doing here? Hey, where's the nurse? You know, I want a soda. And they'd start to get a resentment. And then they'd leave without paying. Okay? And then they'd come back 2 weeks later, you got to help me. I mean, this is what they see in the hospital. They don't see the recoveries because we don't go back there. Because we got to be secret because we're in a 12-step fellowship that's anonymous. Well, I'm telling you, if we want things to change, if we want treatment to get better, if we want discrimination to get better, if we want this illness to be understood better, we need to do our part. There was a study done called The Unmet Need, and they never redid this study because it was so telling. It was done in 1977. It was called The Unmet Need, and it showed the illness and how much money got spent on it in a year. And it started off with cancer. That was at the top. And then it went heart disease, and it went all the way down to the bottom as far as money was concerned. Do you know what got 0.5% just below syphilis? Alcoholism. That ain't right. Not if this illness is affecting more people than cancer and heart disease. It's not right. And for it to change, there has to be some kind of awareness. So one of the things that I've been involved with in the last couple of years is trying to talk about that awareness, you know, to tell people that recovery is possible. Not everybody is part of a chronically relapsing disease. I don't chronically relapse. And it is possible. And you can point people toward an answer and toward a solution. You know, I'm in the early days of AA, when I would hear somebody announce, they would identify and they would say, "My name is so-and-so and I'm a grateful alcoholic." Man, that used to drive me crazy. Because I was anything but grateful. I was just sober. I'm sober today. And somebody would say, you know, I'm so-and-so. I'm a happy, grateful alcoholic. You know, I can't even tell you what I would think. Today, I am a grateful alcoholic. I'm on the other side of that. I understand what a grateful alcoholic is. And here's what I believe a grateful alcoholic is. I've got a progressively fatal illness that is worse than any other illness in the world, because this illness doesn't allow you the dignity of putting your affairs in order when you're on the way out. When you go out, you're at your absolute worst. You've pissed off your family, and everybody just pities you or hates you. You go out in disgrace. Do you know another illness that takes you out in disgrace besides alcoholism or drug addiction? I've got a progressively fatal illness. Now, here's what makes me a grateful alcoholic. The recovery process depends on my participation and my relationship with a loving Creator. And if I participate in this recovery process, I know a new freedom and a new happiness. I get a new perspective on life. My personal relationships fall into order. That sense of anxiety and depression and remorse and guilt leaves me. And all of a sudden, I understand serenity, and I feel it at most times in my life. This recovery process brings me to a complete new life, a complete new world. And how lucky are we to have an illness that the recovery process doesn't just cure our alcoholism, but puts us in the sunlight of the Spirit. David, Stephanie, thank you so much for asking me to come up here. I love you guys. I love Truro. This has been a blast. Thank you.
Keeping in line with what's going on this weekend, Chris, that was a fantastic fantastic message. To thank you properly, I'd ask Adam. Well,
my name's Adam. I'm an alcoholic. When Mike asked me to thank the speaker, I was honored to. I've heard a lot of your stuff before, Chris, and Chris puts this alcoholism in perspective for me in a real simple way, and he gives me a lot of hope as well. But I know I had an experience listening to you tonight, Chris, live. And, you know, not through the CDs, but right having an open experience, and I really appreciate it. And yeah, that's all I can say. What a wonderful message you shared tonight. And we're honored to have you up here carrying this message. All of us are. So thank you very much. I appreciate it. And, yeah, thanks.